Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Jean Machindal. He's a longtime revolutionary proletarian militant. He organized with the Workers' Committee of Rockland County in the 1970s in upstate New York, as well as with a group of Haitian revolutionaries building a mass movement based among workers and peasants during the fall of Duvalier, plus other organizations in the U.S. and Haiti. So thank you so much for being on the program today, Jean.
Oh, thank you, Derek, for giving me the opportunity to speak to your listeners and to you as well.
Well, thank you. Okay, so for my first question, I'd like to dive right in. You know, you talk about the need for revolution, but frankly, you know, we hear revolution all the time. We hear it in commercials for cars, you know, a revolutionary car. This is a revolution. We hear it in advertisements for cereal. We hear it among, you know, mainstream organizations. For crying out loud, politicians talk about the need for revolution. So, and you know, recycling your paper is revolutionary, we hear. So what do you mean by revolution?
What do I mean by revolution? Revolution for me is the radical transformation of a society. It is a political struggle waged by class to impose his own form of social organization of that society. So as you asked the question, we could see that many classes in society have their own definition of revolution. The capitalist class will have his own definition of revolution. And if we take the petty bourgeoisie, that is also a class, they will carry their own definition of revolution. And for example, for the petty bourgeoisie, The revolution for them is for equality. In a sense, this is the form of relation the petty bourgeoisie have with production. So they work with form. They want some sort of equality. So you could see people involved in lifestyle. Lifestyle will see that their action is a revolutionary action. But the revolution in the interest of the working class is, or any dominated class in that sense, is for a total radical transformation of the society. It means the transition from one mode of production, one form of social organization, to another form of social organization. And historically, we have seen, it is not a word that was created, it was a concept that has been constructed in practice. We have seen so far many revolutions, as myself from Haiti, there were the slave revolution in Haiti, where there were a form of social organization that we call as slavery, where the slaves the slave master brought the slave, and the slave worked for the slave master. And basically, the slaves organized themselves, and for a long time, they struggled, they resisted. There were different tendencies among the slaves, and then in the end of the 1700s and the beginning of the 1800s, the slaves developed a revolutionary line and totally destroyed slavery. And Haiti then was under a new form of social organization that now we call feudalism. And we are considered Russian experience in the 1900s, where the working class in Russia organized themselves and organized a revolution and took power. Now, this is not only the working class that did it. The capitalist class also did. In the United States, the capitalist class actually organized a revolution against that revolution was mostly against occupation, the domination of British colonialism over them. And when the American capitalist class saw themselves as capable of leading this country that now they call the United States, they organized themselves, they rallied the masses under their leadership, and they did a revolution, and they took power. So then we have the United States. In England and Germany, the capitalist class did the same. Now, in England and Germany, because of the heavy presence of feudalism, even the Catholic Church at the time, the Catholic class needed to develop their own ideology. And one of the sub-content of that ideology was Protestantism, who went face-to-face with the ideology of feudalism that was being led by the Roman Catholic Church. So really, revolution is a social process. It's a total transformation of that society, and where a new class is taking power and is organizing society in its best interest. So I gave the definition of revolution in general, but the main principle content, the core content of a revolution is a class that is coming to term, coming to maturity, and recognize the way that society is organized is not in its best interest. And that class organized itself and other classes under its leadership in order to take power. So far we had some experiences where I just took Haiti, where we had the slaves and the free slave that organized themselves in unity and took power. And in the United States, the capitalist class did. In Russia, the working class did, even if it was for maybe a 50-year span. The working class in Russia lost power, but even if it was in 50 years, they took power. So this is what we call a revolution. This is from a proletarian, the concept of revolution in the interest of the masses is when a class comes to maturity and wants radical change in that society. So one of the reasons those happen, it is because inside the society they are class struggle, they are resistant. You could well imagine that a slave that is being whipped and work every day relentlessly and every little disagreement they have, they will be whipped, organize themselves and take power. So one of the basic concepts of a revolution is class struggle. And the ultimate goal of class struggle is for power. And the content of that class struggle, the result of that class struggle, of that political power, is revolution, is the radical overthrowing of a class for the political power of another class.
Okay.
So, hello?
Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, and this is what, that's why we call it revolutionary process. But it is not simply a physical act. Revolution is not simply a physical act. It is a physical act because there are armed struggle, there are people fighting on the street, there are people in the mountain, going down to the mountain. But it is a total reorganization of society. It is as well an ideological struggle. If we all remember, for example, when the capitalist class was organizing against feudalism in European countries, they had to fight the ideology of feudalism. They had to, in France, for example, the Renaissance was a struggle against feudalist ideology in all spheres of the society, cultural, writing, because feudalism is a pretty strict concept. There is a form of democracy that they do not agree with. They have a control, a very autocratic control of that society. So the European bourgeoisie at the time, in order to fight, in order to take power, had to ideologically in that society come up with their own ideology, put it on the table. And the Renaissance was one of that experience that we had in most European countries. So, and in Haiti, the concept of freedom for the slave, the concept that this is not the way to live, this is not the way to accept the relationship between humans. The slave had to, in that society overall, had to put those conceptions on the table for a radical transformation. So one cannot accept just one day to wake up and organize a revolution. It's got to be a process. It's got to be a process at all levels. especially it's got to be a process where the ideology and the politics are being transformed, what we call the superstructure. They have to be transformed. They have to take a new road. They have to take a new path in order to achieve those objectives. So it's not simply a physical act. It is also and mostly an ideological act. The physical act is really a short spin. If we could take an experience, for example, in capitalism, in European country, it took them about 300 years before they achieve a capitalist revolution. And in France, capitalism lost power at least 5 times. They had 5 republics. In Haiti, slavery started in 1400. And the slave implemented different form of struggle. They went to parliamentarism. They tried to beat the slave master in their court, in their courtroom, in their democratic structure of the slave master. That did not work. They tried to outsmart the enemy. One time they were under Spain, one the other time they were under France, and that also did not work. And at the end of the process, they came out after a synthesis, I guess. They had a big meeting, and they did a synthesis, and then they found out that only a revolutionary struggle led by a central organization that could unify everybody and wage that struggle and develop a concept, their new concept of freedom, because they could not have a revolution under the concept of freedom of the slave master, because all those societies have their own concept of democracy, because democracy is a political concept. It's the way people regulate their relationship between them, and so democracy is not the what explanation people give us, as a Greek were saying that is the people by the people, is the power of the people for the people. That is not true. That will mean the Greek that came out with that concept had slaves in their own society. That would mean simply that the slaves sat down with their master and discussed with their master how many whips they should be getting for any infraction. So even in the definition of democracy that the Greek came out with, the slaves weren't part of that process. So democracy is always a class-based democracy. It is not for everybody. In the United States or in any capitalist country, we simply benefit from bourgeois democratic rights, meaning the practice that we see inside the society, such as voting, such as the right to speak, such as going to the store and buy whatever you want. But if you look at it at the end of the day, all those are the benefit of capitalism. In a sense that if you can't go to a store and buy, capitalists don't make money. So they have to make sure that you go to a store and buy. So this is a bourgeois democratic right that capitalism is giving you for them to be able to reproduce themselves. So this is their democracy. Democracy is for them. All the law that was taken against the slave in the United States were taken by the slave master. So this was their democracy. As well as in Haiti, apartheid in South Africa, where it was based on their democracy. I don't think the blacks sat down with them and discussed the term of that relationship that existed in South Africa. So democracy is not for everybody. Democracy is simply a class-based. It is the content of democracy is for the reproduction of the class that dominates society. Now, we do enjoy bourgeois democratic rights, such as me talking to you now. But it didn't come. It's not a gift. Bourgeois democratic rights come two ways, and they are not revolution. They are struggle that either, as I said, bourgeois democratic rights come two ways. It either comes from the struggle of the masses, because they are resistant, they are being suffering so much under the act of capital that they have to resist. We all benefit from the 8-hour work day. This is a struggle of the working class. If the working class did not struggle for that, we would be working for capitalism 12, 10, 15 hours a day with minimum pay. So, and in the 8-hour day is not, it's implemented in some capitalist country, but it is not implemented in most of the capitalist country because the masses haven't struggled yet to gain that right. So, and this is why voting is one of the other examples. Voting has nothing to do with democracy. People tend to equate voting with democracy. You know, what sense it will make, you know, that voting, we vote, but we don't have the power to manage that vote. We vote for Obama for him not to go to war, but he still will go to war. So voting is simply a democratic right. So voting has nothing to do with democracy. Democracy is basically the dictatorship of a class over other class. The class define their law, they define their form of reproduction, and then we accept it. Some of those laws of struggle that we wage, for example, the civil rights movement, that will wage some law, some struggle, and those became law down the line. So those were the democratic struggle of the masses, and the democratic struggle of the masses allow us to have some democratic rights. So, and those democratic rights are also attacked to revolution. They need to, they are the little pathways for revolution, but we need to differentiate democratic rights to democracy, but at the same time, democratic right by itself is not enough because it doesn't, democratic right doesn't negate the bourgeois domination over us. It doesn't take it out. For example, in South Africa, the same judges that voted all the apartheid law are the still one in power now. Are the still judges, the 8 judges, are the still the one doing it. So we can't, we do democracy or democratic rights to revolution. Revolution, then, if there were a true revolution in South Africa, it would mean that all those judges would be in jail, actually, because they will not have no right, no reason to be in power anymore. It would mean their classes are no longer in power, and another class come over and take over.
So,
go ahead.
Okay, so you're bringing up so many great points, and there's a few directions I want to go with this. One of them is, so when you're talking about the ideological struggle, that makes me think of, like in the Irish resistance to the British occupation, of the importance, for example, of the Gaelic literature revival, where the Irish had to break their identity as British subjects and remember that they were actually Irish and gain that consciousness as Irish, separate themselves from the oppressor in order to facilitate the struggle and the revolution that came later. That was one thing I was thinking, and you can go with any of these you want. The second thing
It is good. What your point you just pointed out is good. That's why we ourselves we talk about the autonomy of struggle, because if you don't bring your own ideology on the table, there is no way you're going to win. If you don't, for example, capitalism is based on ownership of private property, and we talk of collectivity. Now, if we can offer that alternative of collectivity, if it doesn't become an ideology that the masses agree with, there's no way we're going to win over. But the problem is most of us function, even when we call ourselves progressive or revolutionary, most of us function in our daily struggle on a very individualistic way. And that individualistic concept is what produces private property. It's one of the base for the reproduction of private property. For example, the petty bourgeoisie, really, since they are not producing anything in society, they're really connected to their intellectual capacity. And their intellectual capacity becomes their private property or they'll make somebody else a private property. They'll make an evil out of anybody and make that evil become their private property. And that translates in real life in sectarianism. And so people, if one of them at their backyard, they're fighting over their private property. So it is a reproduction of capitalism. And that's one of the reasons that the left or the movement in general is not ready to unite, because we are reproducing capitalist ideology in our own struggle. And sectarianism is one of that effect. For example, we have made God out of a bunch of dead people. So you will have the, for example, the Trotskyists fighting against the Maoists and the Maoists fighting against so-and-so. And those effects are objectively a reproduction of private poverty, because those guys, they contributed not for us to be fighting over their names. They contributed to a struggle. And only thing we have to do at this moment is to take what is still relevant in their contribution and consolidate them, or to rectify what is no longer possible in their contribution, but advance in our struggle. But the fighting over those names is an effect, what we call sectarianism. But at the same time, we need to say outside, frankly, it is a reproduction of capitalism ideology. It has nothing to do with collectivity. We ourselves, our political current, talk of we got to make those people's contribution the collective property of the masses. So I'm going to read them, I'm going to study from them, I'm going to learn from them, and I will take what I think is positive and make it the collective. There will be no name attached to it. It will be our collective knowledge. That knowledge has to become collective. It has to become the property of us all. Whether we disagree with some of it, whether we learn from those experiences, but they have to come, they have to be our own property, or else we will not be have a revolution, because they cannot be a Trotskyist revolution, they cannot be a Maoist revolution, and they cannot be an environmentalist revolution. That will never happen. You know, and this is what identity politics is the corner, is the ultra individualism of self preservation. So go ahead.
Well, I would love to ask you about identity politics in a moment. And I'd love for you to return to that, but what I'd really like to do now is go back for a second, and you've talked a lot about class, and I think that this will work to talk about identity politics too. Can you define class as, I mean, a class is not just simply some oppressed social group. There's a distinction. So first, what is a class? What is an oppressed social group? What is an identity group? And what are the differences between those three?
Okay. A class is a group of people that most importantly share at the level of production, the economy, some similarity.
So, and give me examples of each one when you go too.
For example, the capitalist class. Let me take an industrial capitalist, because they are a different fraction of the capitalist class. Let me take the industrial fraction of the capitalist class. The capitalist class is in relationship to capital. He doesn't produce that capital. He only manages it. In the sense that he have a factory, and he manages the factory, and the factory produces chairs, car, a table. And what the capitalist class does is he actually make that profit is private property. The profit that he doesn't make, there is no intimacy between him and the production that he is doing. He only manages it. And this is the difference between capital and the capitalist class. Capital is what is the valorization of product. Every product in for capital has a value to it. And capital have extended that concept of value to everything. It's now, even if you die today, you have a value for capital. They have to organize your funeral. The funeral has to be expensive. They'll give you different level of burying you. And the most expensive one could be at least about $20,000, $40,000, and the cheapest one could be $600. So capital has been able to make a value out of anything. And this is what happened, for example, to our movement. You know about Greenpeace. And the non-governmental agency have been able to also have value for capital. So they are able to recuperate that. So that's the capitalist class itself. And I took an example of industrial capital that produced sitting behind his desk, and the workers, now I'm going to give you an example of the working class. The workers goes into the factory and produce. And by the way, there's a good book that I think Stephanie McMillan just put out, and that book is about capitalism as dying, and that book really explains, for myself in a limited way, but I think it's very positive, what is a working class. And I think people should visit our website and try to see if they could get it, buy it from us. But the working class, what we call the worker, is somebody who produces surplus value. He goes to work for 8 hours, and after that 8 hours, you only get paid 1 hour if you look at the relationship, and that's a relationship. And the 7 hours is surplus value. And that surplus value, the capitalist class makes it its private property. And that surplus value is the source of all other capital. It is that surplus value that allows them to be in the stock market, to invest, to destroy the environment. Because the capital is very aggressive. Capital is an abstract. It's not a human. So he's got no feeling. He's got nothing attached to it. Everything capital touch is going to have value to it. Now, for example, now in the moon, they are trying to see if there is, they are opening, I think NSA, NASA, is opening for prospectus for mining companies to go up there and see what is there for them to make a value to it. So they'll destroy anything because capital have no sense of human. They have no sense of consciousness. And the capitalist class, and that's the problem with the people who come with the concept of a lesser evil or a good capital, there is no such thing. Because the capitalist class always obey the system of practice of capital. The capitalist class, like I said, is a managerial class. And capital is that abstract, is that structure. And the capitalist class is the practice. So even if there is a good capitalist class, is it a good capitalist human being, capital will teach him a lesson. Capital will impose his will on that guy and make sure he complies to the need of capital. And the need of capital is for valorization. So the workers produce that. And it produces that surplus, and the capitalist class takes that surplus and make a value to it. If we have if you analyze the historical development of capitalism in the United States, most of the bankers that we know now, such as started as industrial capitalists. They get their money, the Ford did. And now they transition to banking. Rockefeller is one of them with oil, Standard Oil, and all those things. It's all of them. All of them that went into the banking started as industrial capitalists. And that's the working class. The working class produced that capital. The working class have an intimacy with capital. But the only thing the working class doesn't do, they don't share that surplus with that working class. That's why we call the relationship of capital to the working class, the relationship of exploitation. This is where the concept of exploitation comes in. And we have the petty bourgeoisie. The petty bourgeoisie are the ones that help circulate the capital. They manage, they are in the banking industry. They are the tellers. They are the teachers. They They participate in the circulation of capital. They don't produce it. They don't produce surplus value. A lot of people will disagree with it, with that concept, but this is our way of interpretation. I know there is a lot of struggle. There is a lot of discussion around what it is, the role of the petty bourgeoisie. Everybody, people, some tendency think as long as you work, you are a worker. For us, the working class is the one that solely produces surplus value. Then the surplus value is mean that there is a product. That's why we call it productive. That's why we call it a productive aspect. There is a product being made, and that product is being sold with for a profit. And it is not simply a circulation of good or a circulation of knowledge, such as a teacher would do or a doctor. So it's about relationship to production. So it's not a group of people, but it's really about a relationship to production. So that's the class in itself. That's a rough definition of what the class is.
And to back up a second, just when you were talking early on about revolutions, and you talked about revolutions in Haiti, and you talked about the revolutions that brought capitalists to power, and just so we're clear, the American Civil War, even though it officially abolished slavery, would not have been a revolution, because that was actually a conflict between two factions within capitalism. Is that correct?
Yeah, totally agree with you. Yes, it is. I was talking about the Independence War. That's why I took the example of England. The capitalist class came to maturity and saw they could actually, whatever England was doing, they could have done it themselves.
So if there's a fight between the bankers, and even if this fight becomes physical, if there's a fight between the banking faction and the, I'm just making this up, and the, I don't know, the mining faction, that and one side wins, that is in no way a revolution, because that's merely one capitalist class.
Yes, I do agree.
Gaining ascendance over another capitalist class.
Yeah, I do agree with you. In fact, we called it the struggle over opposing interests. It is not a class. It is not an antagonistic struggle of classes, but it is a struggle of opposing interests. And in fact, this is what the failure of Occupy was. Occupy did not understand the failure, the difference between the difference between opposing interests and antagonistic interests.
Tell me more about that.
Well, Occupy started as a movement that people were protesting against the declining mode of capitalism. And they were blaming the bankers. They were blaming different faction form of concentration of capital. But among the capitalist class itself, they are opposing interests. In fact, competition is an opposing interest of capitalism. It also transfers to the political aspect. The competition you see between two capitalist institutions, let's say Sears, for example, and Walmart, is the same competition you see between the Democratic Party and the Republican Party. So it is a competition. It is a competition based on opposing interests. It is not a class antagonism. It is totally secondary. So Occupy was based, the movement itself was based on a very secondary opposition of interest in among the capitalist class itself. And the danger of that is that if they don't articulate correctly, it may create a social base for fascism. Because fascism usually enters the political field. It's a conjuncture of capitalism. And it usually enters the political field to resolve those opposing interests of capitalism. So, for example, Germany fascism under Hitler was an exceptional conjuncture of capitalism to address the secondary opposing interests of capitalism. It didn't touch capitalism. BMW, VW, Boeing, Lufthansa, all those capitalist institutions benefited from Hitler fascism. The many people were sent as work, free trade, free labor. The Jews were sent as free labor, and the extra one were gassed because they could not. If they did not gas them, they had to feed them. That's when the surplus value produced at that moment, some of it will have gone back and feed them. So it is the opposing interest. So in fact, you just took an example. The banking is a form of concentration of capital. Always is in struggle with industrial capital. The tendency for them to fusion is there. But they also do share opposing interests. On the start of industrial capitalism, credit was a no-no. They did not want to give credit because credit for Ford is and affected his cash flow. He needed you to come and buy the car for cash. And Ford, even he was a capitalist guy, was fighting to raise the minimum wage. Because he wanted people to come and buy his car. But he wanted cash because that's the only way he could rebuy the equipment, he could restart the cycling back up again. So he, in the beginning of it, he was fighting over industrial capital. The crisis we have now, the reason they had to bail out from the companies and the, either the Republican Party and the Democratic Party had to split. Give some to industrial capital. They give some to GM. They give some to Ford, and then they have to give some to the banking and to the banking thing because it is a struggle. It is a struggle of two opposing interests of capitalism, and those are for us and the masses. They are secondary. They are secondary contradiction because both of them are our enemy. Both of them. When they face us, they are our enemy. But if we don't do that, if we ally against with one to the other one, at the end of the day, they're going to restructure themselves up and eat us alive. So there are opposing interests of inside the capitalist class itself. There are struggles. There are struggles between the big, the small businesses to the big one. But all of them have the same objective. All of them is as soon as you get into the store, is to juice you alive, take everything out of your pocket. And there is no such thing. For example, now Whole Food, who started as good conscientious capitalism, is actually buying fish in prison. They are doing that because capital have to teach them. We'll teach them this is what to do. This is what you got to do because my job is not to save people's lives. My job is to make money, more. So this is not about people's life. Who give a damn if they have cancer? In fact, some of the capitalists will make money on them if they have cancer. There is another value. But our job is to make more. So this is that constant struggle that exists. So therefore, there are opposing interests among the capitalist class, and there are contradictions between us and them. For example, the Civil War you just mentioned were a struggle of opposing interests. They were the same class. One found out that, buying the labor power was cheaper than slavery because the slave owner had to go there, take care of the slave when he was sick, house the slave, feed him, even if he feed him badly, but he still had to feed them. But under the industrial the conception of the North, you come to work for 8 hours and you go home. We don't care if you don't have money to feed your kids. We will not share that surplus with you. The capitalists of South was we have to share the surplus a portion of that surplus had to go back to slaves because we have to. Put clothes, feed, house them, and take care of them. Even if he was a veterinarian coming there to take care of them, but somebody had to take care of them.
And the return on capital for slaves was not actually that high. It was about 5%.
Yeah, that's because they have to, the surplus have to go back. So I understand that. It's not, so the different, so, but the contradiction between the North and the South were opposing interests. Now, we have to understand one thing. When bourgeois democratic structure are no longer able to absorb the opposing interests, coup d'etat, which apply in most other countries, or civil war, is one of the mechanisms of bourgeois democracy. Civil war, coup d'etat are all bourgeois concepts. This is how the bourgeois in election, all three of them, are a form that the bourgeoisie use to resolve their internal opposing interests. Revolution is how we, the masses, will use to overthrow them. But so they have their own concept. So we just clarify one thing. They are the concept that is revolution, which is a total transformation of a society. And you will have election, civil war, or coup d'etat as a form of the capitalist class used to address their own internal contradiction, their own opposite interests. So this is the one of the reasons that we need to be clear of what we're doing. So Occupy was, even though people didn't know it clearly, was addressing the opposing interests of the capitalist class. And at the end of the day, it benefited the Democratic Party. Most of those organizations of the petty bourgeoisie that weren't occupied, except for the most radical one, but in general, most of them drained from NGO to as a social base for the Democratic Party. Most of them became NGO. You know, a whole lot of them, the .org organization became NGO, and they were present, the union, all of them were present, and they were addressing those opposing interests. And the problem is when the masses engage in those struggle without a clear class conscience, without a clear cut orientation, we become the tool of fraction, form of concentration of capital. We knowingly or unknowingly, we become their tool. We become their instrument. We become their thing that we stand on in order for us to stay straight. So it is important for us to understand when we engage in struggle, we do develop a clear class interest and objective. So we don't become tools of one fraction of the capitalist class itself. And that's why we always call for autonomy of our struggle. We have to be able to enter the struggle based on our own position. And in fact, this is, I think, one of the contributions that we are waging, even on the environmentalist movement. Without a clear class objective, as proven before and still being proven now, the environmentalist movement will inevitably be under the influence of one fraction of capitalism.
Go ahead.
Gore has already taken a good chunk of it. So,
a couple things. One of them is,
yes,
you know, there's a pretty interesting and I think very important question that is raised right there that has been asked a lot lately, which is how does the environmental movement stop being about protecting the real world and become about making capitalism more, quote, sustainable, end quote, and basically continuing it. You know, environmentalism at one point was about protecting real places, and it has become putting in windmills. And that's the process you're talking about right there. So I wanted to mention that. And then also, I also just wanted to say that everything you've said is, I think this has been a tremendous education for, will be a tremendous education for all the listeners on sort of the foundations of revolution and some of the terms. But unfortunately, we only have like 2 minutes left. several.
Oh my God.
Yeah. And everything you're saying is I think very important. And I guess the way I'd like to, and I would like to interview you again another time in the future where we can talk about some more details, but and also talk more about Haiti. But for right now, with 2 minutes left, I guess what I'd like to ask is, if listeners agree with your concept of revolution, what do you think that these listeners need to be doing right now?
Well, first, they need to organize themselves. We have developed a concept of organization where we have to be able to develop our own theory. Theory is an interpretation of reality. Theory is not reality. We have to understand the reality. And we have to be able to understand all the dynamic of that reality. And understand also not only the dialectical relationship that that is inside that reality, but most importantly, the contradiction that allow that reality to reproduce itself. And we have to organize ourselves in a collective way in order to transform it. But that organization I'm talking about cannot be an organization that is similar to bourgeois organization. It has to be an organization where we are able to produce, even in a very embryonic form, our own ideology. We have to be able to do it and act. So it is not something we're going to sit in a living room and talk about. We have to be out there. We have to be organizing people. We will make mistakes. But we have to be able to rectify. We have to be able to consolidate. We have to be able to learn from other people's struggle without taking them as God, without making them become God, because they're already dead. Their orientation they did was for their own reality. We are dealing now with the new reality. We could use their contribution as a foundation to understand the one we're doing now, because there is not that such a difference. Of course, reality evolved, but it did not evolve such a way where their contribution is no longer valid. Their contribution are still valid, but we have to be able to take it, learn from it, and develop our own. So this is what now. If people want to get in touch with us, this is something totally different. They could visit, for example, Stephanie McNerman's site. She have a daily affirmation that she produces every day. People could follow them, and they could contact her directly, and then we will be able to discuss and organize. And even if whether they agree or don't agree with us, and one thing we are sure about, we are not sectarian. We will work at anybody with anyone based on the level of unity we share with them. If you are somebody in the environment, if there is a level of unity we can work together, we will work together and bypass all those sectarian and sectorial struggle that exists. We are not involved in sectarian struggle, and we are not interested in getting involved in sectarian struggle. If somebody wants to be a Trotskyist, go talk to Trotsky about it. You know, it is not our duty to do so. The man is dead. If you have the capacity to talk to him, fine. But we will learn from it. We will disagree. We will agree with some of the things he wrote. We will agree with some of the things he wrote. And if some of the things he wrote is still applicable, we will implement it because they are scientific. If somebody tell me the doctor who come with something, even if I disagree with that doctor, I will follow the example of the doctor. It doesn't make a sense because it is scientific. It is a scientific approach. If somebody have a critic on somebody else, we should do it and convince me. Don't try to impose your will on me, but just convince me. And if I do agree, I will advance. If I don't agree, you go your way and I go my way. But we will meet inevitably because as long as we are involved in the struggle, we will inevitably meet.
Well, thank you so much for saying all that, John. And
thank you.
Thank you for your work. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. And my guest today has been Jean Macandal. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.